Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Well, this week I am so thrilled to have Krista Faust on the podcast. She is someone that I've enjoyed for the last few years following on Twitter. We're mutuals. She has amazing taste in film. She's a talented writer. She is just one of the coolest women that I follow, and I all encourage you to do the same. So Krista Faust writes crime novels, comics, and tie-ins. She worked in the Times Square peep booths as a professional dominatrix and in the adult film industry, both behind and in front of the cameras. Her forthcoming hard case crime novel, The Get Off, the final book in the Angel Dare trilogy, is set in the world of rodeo and will be out in February of 2025. Krista, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I couldn't be more excited about this. Any excuse to ramble on and on and on about the misfits, I'm there.
Yes. Yeah, when we were thinking of ideas, I know that you're passionate about that movie, and I didn't know about your interest in rodeo overall in the new novel, so that is very exciting. What can you tell us about The Get Off?
Well, this is kind of like, it's funny, The Misfits really is a movie about endings, and The Get Off is a novel about endings. It's the end of the trilogy. It's the end of an era for me personally. It has a lot of the same sort of meta weight behind it that you see in a lot of these old cowboy movies that are talking about the passing of one era and the ushering in of a new one. So it kind of felt appropriate. And with the Angel Dare novels, each one is kind of set within a demimonde that has its own, you know, work slang and its own code. And, you know, people who are looking from the outside don't really know what they're all about. So the first one was set in the adult film industry. Second one was MMA. And this one is rodeo. And I saw a very distinct thematic connection between people who don't really have much else to sell other than their physicality. Mm-hmm. And the notion of selling your physicality for the entertainment of others in a way that can cause very serious physical harm,
yeah,
you know, was fascinating to me. So that was kind of the through line between those books. And rodeo, I think, is kind of like the granddaddy of beat yourself up for money.
Yeah, really. It's like rodeo, boxing. I love this idea of MMA, the adult film industry, and that is a definite distinct link. I just watched the other day the interview that you did with Megan Abbott at Left Coast Crime. It's on YouTube. I will link to it. I loved it so much. You guys talked about rabbit holes and how writers, I mean, we're so curious. We're going to, you know, watch. Sometimes when I watch a movie, I have to pause it because I want to know, like, the eighth person in the frame, like, what was he in something that I just saw? And then I go down the, what happened to him? What, you know, what was his life like? And so I loved that you guys were talking about in her books, competition, and she kind of went into physicality with, you know, cheerleading and ballet and the different avenues she's explored, gymnastics. And you were saying that you kind of do the same thing. You get these topic crushes, I think was the phrase you used. And so it was
exactly.
Yeah. Were you watching rodeo movies and The Misfits more than usual when you're working on this, or has rodeo always been in the back of your mind?
It really was The Misfits that kind of sparked this trend, because I was very interested in chronic traumatic encephalopathy, you know, aka punch drunk syndrome.
Yeah.
And I kind of explored that a little bit in my second Angel Dare book, in as far as the MMA world. And then obviously, even more so with rodeo. And I just became obsessed with, there's a moment in The Misfits where the Rosalind character asks Purse, why are you doing this? You're yeah. already hurt. Why do you keep doing this? And he just kind of looks at her and says, well, I'm Ennard. And it's just like the profound weight of that seemingly simple line of this is just what I do. This is who I am. I yeah. mean, there is no other world outside of this. And I think that for me, meeting a lot of the guys, I have a tendency not just to fall down rabbit holes online, but like actually get out in the world. Yeah. I mean, I rolled with students at Bill Korchevichian's MMA school in Glendale, and I traveled for 2 years with rodeo bullfighters.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, I mean, I put my foot down and say, hey, you want to get in there and do some rounds? And I'm like, no, absolutely under no circumstances. No, forget it. Unless you have those paddles to like revive me after I die of a heart attack, as yeah. soon as I see like a 3-month calf coming towards me, I'll just fall over dead. That's it. It'll be the end mm-hmm. of me. But I did do some rounds with the little, the bicycle. There's a training device that a lot of the bullfighters okay. use that has a single wheel and handles and a set of horns.
So you get the,
so you can practice, yeah. practice your rounds. So, wow. so yeah, so that, so becoming obsessed with The Misfits and thinking about this final book and endings and the narrative beneath The Misfits, which I think is really about being a writer more than it is about being a cowboy, but that's kind of the veneer that's over it to make it palatable towards the audiences. But yeah. that was what drew me into The Misfits. And then once I became obsessed with The Misfits, that's when I started going down that rabbit hole. I originally thought I was going to write about bull riders okay. because I yeah. knew more about bull riders, and they kind of seemed more in the forefront in a lot of the movies that I was watching.
Yeah.
But I wound up writing about the bullfighters because I found them infinitely more interesting.
Mm-hmm. That is fascinating. And I love that you said you were interested in traumatic brain injuries, because growing up, one of my grandma, Eleanor, was one of those women who could like walk down the street or go to the grocery store and come back with like 6 phone numbers. And so she always had like a million boyfriends, and she just would take us places. And one of the sweetest men that was just like madly in love with her, and it didn't work, but he was just really sweet and really cute. His name was Louis. And he had been a boxer and he was punch drunk. And he talked about how he'd been in the ring, and this would have been, you know, like the 60s or whatever, 50s. And somebody had loaded their glove with like washers and really went to town on him. And so, you know, sometimes when he would be talking, he would lose his train of thought or that kind of thing. And he was a total sweetheart, but that has always fascinated me ever since meeting him. So I love that that was kind of a driving force of your interest as well.
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you, one of the guys who helped me with the MMA book was a kid, a young kid who was just training for his first fight. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him, and I also talked to his coach. And I asked him, do you know anyone who is having these issues, who's
oh yeah
punch drunk or having memory issues? And he's like, no, I don't know anybody like that. Okay, fine. You know, you're 17, whatever.
Yeah.
So then I asked the same question to his coach, who was, you know, in his early 40s. Mm-hmm. And you know, do you know anybody that's having these issues? And he says, yeah, me. He's like, after this interview, I'm not going to remember your name, he said.
Mm.
And I was like, what?
That's heartbreaking.
Wow. Like, yeah. you are spending 12 hours a day with this guy training. Yeah. And you 17-year-old, you don't see that because you don't want to.
Yes. You know, you're focused on, the blinders are on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, I think, in order to do it, you can't admit that that's a possibility, kind of like the adrenaline, sort of, the, now I'm going to blank on it, the line from Junior Bonner about, oh, and it's also in The Lusty Men, never was a horse that couldn't be rode or a rider that couldn't be thrown.
Rider that couldn't be thrown. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, let's just state for the record that it is not a one-way ticket.
Oh,
I mean, there are guys who have a cement head,
yes,
who are just fine and go on to live totally normal, fine
like
lives.
Football. Yeah,
exactly. And there's guys who maybe got like a slight like walking knockout one time.
Yes,
and you just it's a gamble.
It's luck of the draw.
It's a gamble every time. Luck of the draw, which incidentally is a rodeo term.
Oh, wow.
What is the luck of the draw?
Yeah.
The luck of the draw is which bull did you get? Which bronc did you get? Oh, what's the draw? Oh, I got Bushwhacker. Oh, you know, that's the luck of the draw. Whatever ride you get, whatever bull you pull, that's your ride. You have to ride it.
Oh, wow. Were there ones that they were like, oh, damn, I drew whatever? Did they know the animals very, very well?
Oh, I mean, they study them like athletes. I mean, it's the same as fighters. Fighters know their opponents and guys know the bulls.
Mm.
They know, you know, I think there's a, God, again, oatmeal is up here. Was it, I guess it was 8 seconds where they're having this kind of conversation about, is he going to spin or is he going to bolt? You know, does he spin left or does he spin right? It's like the guys know all this stuff. They follow the bulls and they learn. Plus, the way that rodeo scoring works is that if you could be really talented cowboy and if you get a lousy ride, you're going to get a low score because 50% goes to the bull and 50% goes to the rider. So, you know, if you have a really rank bull, I mean, I have this is my, I don't know if you can read this on camera. This is my new tattoo. It says right rank.
Okay.
Right. Because there is a phrase, ride rank, bank, meaning you're not going to make big money by riding tame bulls. You have to ride the hard ones. You have to ride the dangerous ones. You have to ride the powerful ones. That's how you get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And the bullfighters use the same phrase, but they say fight. So it's, you know, fight rank, make bang.
Mm. Ah, that's kind of cool. Yeah. Do you know that your next topic crush, you have a new world you're getting interested in? Or are you still like digging into rodeo?
I certainly do, but it's a
secret. Okay.
Currently very hush hush.
Okay.
On the QT.
All right. Well, at least we know it's there and I can't wait to get into that world next, I'm sure. And everyone's very excited now. But talking about rodeo movies, I know we could have taken this a million directions, but I love this idea. I had no idea that you had spent 2 years following rodeo cowboys around. That's so exciting. Was that here throughout the U.S.? Did you go into Canada, Mexico?
I was not able to make it up to Canada or down to Mexico. I primarily traveled through Texas, Oklahoma, Utah, some Northern California. I just sort of let them lead me. So wherever they were going, that's the rodeo trail. Like whatever's next, I'll see you on down the trail. And I started in Helotes, Texas.
Okay.
And when I basically cold called the stock contractor and I said, look, you know, I'm looking to talk to some rodeo people for a book I'm working on. You know, can I come down? And they're like, you want to come here? You want to come to Helotes? You don't want to like go to the PBR or like the National Rodeo Finals, or you want to come to our little rodeo?
Yeah.
And I said yes, because I wanted that small experience. I wanted a little clicky environment where everybody knew everybody else.
Yeah.
And like I said, that's when I thought I was going to write about the writers. But when I actually met people, I got much more interested in the world of not just the, I believe they're now referring to themselves as rodeo protection athletes, but the bullfighters, and not just in their job protecting the cowboys, but also freestyle, which is kind of another kind of a world within a world that I got interested in. So.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. That's really interesting. And I know something that you said attracts you to certain characters was something you and Megan Abbott talked about, which is outsiders or sort of like the audience surrogate or a way in. In Megan's books, you mentioned they were kind of the second in command, sort of the person telling the story. Like, it's not as interesting to follow, you know, the queen bee or whatever. It's the underling as they're telling the story. Or she talked about like Nick Carraway and Great Gatsby is a little bit more interesting because he's kind of an enigma and you catch on to things later. And one thing I noticed watching all of these movies and the ones that we chose, I'm sure we're going to reference a bunch of other ones, were The Lusty Men, The Misfits, The Rider, Neon Bull, and Bull, the 2019 film. I know there's a lot of movies with that title. Those are the films, is especially the early ones. And I think maybe one other one, Bull, for sure. It's usually a female character who's kind of the audience surrogate or who isn't really part of the world getting acquainted with the way of these cowboys, how they live their life. And it seems senseless or dangerous, or they're trying to figure out what would draw somebody to do this. And of course, Marilyn Monroe's character is like the ultimate. I know The Misfits means the most and is kind of your gateway. Do you want to start there?
Oh God. I mean, you know, I remember seeing The Misfits on the big screen for the first time and just being so struck and like emotionally overwhelmed by how broken Monroe is in that movie, how hard she's trying to hold it together. And there's a real, it feels to me like there's a real tension between Arthur Miller's concept of her and what he wanted her to be in that movie and what she actually is. And there's a little a throwaway line in Some Like It Hot where the character of Sugar is talking about how she keeps falling for lousy guys.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's supposed to be just kind of a frothy, funny throwaway line, but she has this moment where she is talking about how dumb the character is. I'm so stupid. I keep falling for these guys because, you know, because I'm blonde.
Yeah.
It's again, a throwaway line. Throwaway lines have a tendency to stick with me for some reason. But she has this line where she says, you know, because I'm stupid. And it's like, and you could just feel this like volcanic, barely contained rage at her kind of being pigeonholed as that bimbo. And you know, she went from Some Like It Hot to The Misfits, where ostensibly she's surrounded by method actors and she has her the name has escaped. She has her coach with her, you know, and she's really trying to make it into this like real actor mode to break away from the bimbo mentality. But yet she's has this love letter written to her by a man who doesn't really understand her.
Yes.
And that was fascinating to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think a lot of people didn't understand her. I was looking at John Huston interviews, this book this morning that I got a few years ago when I did an episode on John Huston. He gives a great interview. Sometimes he contradicts himself, and some of the stories seem a little bit like they're tall tales, of course, but they're
don't
always
we all, right?
Yes. And he was talking about how Sartre really revered Marilyn. And he said it was kind of an eye-opener to realize that Europeans held her in very high regard, much higher than just a sex goddess. They thought she was a very fine actress, too. And she was, oddly enough, not an actress in the technical sense, but she had that ability to go down within herself and pull up an emotion and give it. And he said, like, even he said she seemed doomed pretty much. They had to stop production. She was committed for a little bit. The doctor on set stopped giving her medicine because she needed pills to wake up, pills to go to sleep, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then she got them elsewhere, and how it was just they felt like they were watching this woman, you know, kind of disintegrate in their eyes. But then they said, but then she would do these things. And he talked about how he said he later regretted it. He yelled at Arthur Miller, saying, you know, and like thinking he had more control over her than he actually did, about how can you let her do this to herself or with these pills? And he didn't realize the extent of what was going on in their marriage and how they were kind of like, you know, running parallel, essentially. And Arthur was trying to kind of shape her, I think, and she couldn't. Yeah.
Well, I think she just simply refused.
Yes.
To be shaped. But you know, you think of that moment where she's leaning on the Guido character. She's saying, you know, snapping. It's like we're all gonna die. We're all gonna die. And I just like that just cuts right to my heart, that line.
Yeah. Yeah, because the film, of course, became famous later. Unfortunately, it was Curse of the Misfits. Clark Gable died 12 days later, which was a total shock. And, you know, this was her last film. And then Monty Cliff made like three others, including one more for Huston, which he said he wouldn't have cast him if he knew like how bad off he was when they made Freud. Yeah. But yeah, this movie, it's definitely... It needs sort of that, I guess, that energy, or they're playing on their pain like all actors do. I find, and Huston admits this, he said, what people got wrong is they all just assumed like men loved her or whatever. Women loved Marilyn too, for a lot of different reasons. Like we could relate to her. We wanted to protect her. Some wanted to be her. She was somebody, I think, that everybody saw something different in, and she had all these sides to her. And one thing he kept saying is there were so many sides to her that he didn't know that nobody was going to know. Yeah.
Yeah. I think she played that up for sure.
Yeah.
That, you know, kind of chameleon like ability to reflect not just men's desire, but anyone's desire back at them. And I think she kind of used that in the character of Rosalind, because here is, I mean, on the page, this childlike woman, which I mean, really, but this woman who is the center of the sort of drawing in all of this desire from all these different directions. And I mean, even the Thelma Ritter character is like looking at her as like, I'm going to live through you. You're going to have something that I never had, you know? So, and there she is in the middle, this enigma.
Yeah. And oh my goodness. I mean, everyone talks about Clift and Gable and Monroe, but I love, you know, Wallach and Thelma Ritter.
Yeah.
I just did an episode on Thelma Ritter with Nell Minow, and Nell brought up something really good, like what made her so special is she said, and she cited Marilyn, she said, you know, a character actor has to be able to be perfect all 80 takes, like a star just whenever, because you never know when the star is going to hit. And so
Especially when that star is Marilyn. When it's
Marilyn. Yes, exactly. Like she's got to deliver every time. They've got to, you know, do that. Yeah. And
Thelma Ritter, Thelma Ritter as Mo. Pick up on South Street. that her death scene, no spoilers. That's just like my, like, you know, Kleenex box. Like I can't with that. It's so good. So perfect.
Yeah. Oh, she's amazing. Yes. I love Thelma Ritter. And of course, Eli Wallach, just great. I think, you know, this is a film I think I might have seen too early, and it kind of went over my head, but it stayed with me. And I remember when I revisited it a few times, like the next time I revisited it, I had seen Last Picture Show. And it's funny when you see the movies that came later and you realize just how much they pulled mm-hmm. from this movie, like the sound design and the visuals. Houston talked about how he thought black and white could convey thought better than color. He said you want to see, he said in color, you're looking at the color of their eyes, but in black and white, what's behind the eyes. And he said, and that's what he wanted for this one. That's, yeah. I never thought of that. Yeah.
That's really good. And you know, it's funny. When I first watched this movie, I was really deeply irritated by Clark Gable and his kind of hammy, old fashioned kind of acting. And then the more I watched it, the more I realized, again, these are these levels of like meta meaning, is that in the same way that you have like the old school versus the new school and the dying breed. I just recently rewatched for the zillionth time Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Because I kind of saw a parallel there too, to, you know, Gable's character in The Misfits and Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard, and how they're both representative of this older era. And here you have this older actor who is sort of a heartthrob and didn't really have to do anything other than be tall.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then he's up against these like heavy hitting method people like Eli Wallach, you know, who are like sort of a new style of acting, a new school of acting. And that tension between them, he's on the ground with the rope and Eli Wallach is in the sky with the plane. It just, every level is resonance.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And also he's kind of, it also works to his favor. And again, yeah, I wouldn't have guessed this on a first viewing either, because I probably would have seen the, oh, it's, you know, Gone with the Wind, Gable, that kind of style. But what you're seeing here is he is playing a guy who's playing a guy. Like, he knows, like, this is machismo. This is what we're supposed to do. And, you know, kind of the way, like, John Wayne, well, he always had the walk, but, you know, if you've ever seen an actor who is just one way when you're talking to them, and then they walk on a set or they walk in front of like a group of people and the walk changes a little bit, if it's a group of guys or what. And you can kind of see that with Gable a little bit, like he's going to fall back on these ideas of, you know, showmanship and being a cowboy and like, well, this is what we're supposed to do. And so he isn't able to get as vulnerable with her as somebody like the Montgomery Clift character does. And I'm so glad you brought up that scene with him and Allie, and she's like so worried about it. It's one of the most beautiful scenes. Yeah.
It really is. It really is. And at the same time as, you know, Gable is kind of doing this like real hammy, big silent movie expressions with his face, you see like there's a moment with Monty Cliff where it's at the very end where she's saying goodbye and she says, you know, don't get hurt anymore, Purse. He doesn't answer, but his little tiny sort of expression, it just says everything.
Yeah.
And just watching that, you know, the older actors going down, and you would have thought younger is going up, but they're not going anywhere either because nobody makes it out of this movie alive.
It's a hard film to watch. Like, it is very meta when you're watching it. You're very painfully aware, kind of like you can't watch the James Dean movies anymore without immediately thinking the iconography of James Dean and what he would become, especially like Rebel. Performances, and you know, Sal Mineo, and it's hard to watch a Natalie Wood movie without thinking later, but yeah, this is a film that was made like almost a decade after The Lusty Men, which is kind of one of my favorites too, another rodeo film, and it's sort of like both of these very dark, almost like noirish kind of statements on rodeo. They're westerns, but they're neo-westerns. I think these are two very fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely, I mean, I think there's a theme, a sort of an overarching theme that fits older films, including Junior Bonner, even though it's kind of a bridge, fits those older films into this one category of thing, and then the newer films kind of come in and are exploring in different areas. But I think that The Misfits is the most explicit in the way that it talks about the scene where Gay and Rosalind are supposedly going to sleep the night before they round up the Mustangs, and they're talking, and he talks about, you know, they changed it. I didn't change. They changed it all around and they made it ugly.
Yep.
And brings up her being a dancer as a parallel, that like you start off all optimistic and open.
Wide-eyed,
and you just love dance and it's who you are inside. And then they turn it around and they make it ugly and you're still doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. But their reaction, it curdles, it becomes awful. And that the same perspective of the cowboy on the open range, and that you're, you know, it's better than wages. And there you are being a real man, rugged individual out on the steep by yourself riding. And to me, that entire speech is a speech about what it means to be a writer in Hollywood, because you have this optimism, and writing is who you are. It's what you do. Mm-hmm. And you don't feel like you've changed, but yet somehow now it all plays out on a U-boat, or, you know, do you think it could be a Betty Hutton, you know, like you sell out and the next thing you know, you're just making dog food. You know, and you still feel like you're the same person. And I feel like The Lusty Men is also, in a way, a little bit of that same metaphor of the death of rugged individualism and the sort of ushering in of the modern era of, you know, a more domesticated version of American masculinity.
Yeah. And I love what you were saying too about it being really about writing. It's kind of that old line about all movies are really about movie making, like no matter what we're covering, it's about the creative process. Yeah. And you can kind of see that. And also watching it when you're a creative writer or whatever your background is, you're going to maybe see something in that. Nobody watches the same movie the same way. But I think that's a really good parallel when you were talking about that. I couldn't help but think of Sunset Boulevard and, you know, another movie. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We had faces then, and then the writer, and and kind of the battle.
And they changed it all around. Yes. They made it ugly. And, you know, you used to have talent, but this year I'm just trying to make a living. Like, all that resonates. And I think in The Lusty Men, it's not as overt. It's more hidden, but there is definitely something to be said about the notion of somebody who is, you know, like like the Robert Mitchum character in that film, he is never going to change. He's never going to be, you get that little tease of like, maybe he could have a different life. Yeah. Maybe he could settle it, but he knows he can't, just like Purse in the Misfits with that look of, you know, don't get hurt again. And you know, he will, mm-hmm. you know, he will. And you don't see him die, but no. you know, he's headed there.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that he actually does in real life just makes it that much more poignant. Mm-hmm. But it's the same in The Lusty Men, where you have this arc of, I can't do anything else. I can't adapt to the modern world. Mm-mm. You know, this is who I am. I was born this way. I'll die this way.
Yeah. That's kind of what I saw when I rewatched Junior Bonner last night. Same thing. Like, he's just going to keep doing it. You know, it's ostensibly like to help the family or whatever, but he's just going to, as he says, go down the road, follow the rodeo, like go on to the next one, essentially the end of the movie. And yeah. And I think The Lusty Men also, just like you were talking about with The Misfits, The Lusty Men is kind of a, be careful what you wish for, fame and fortune. Like, you get into this and it's exciting and you think you can control it or you want the money. And then you realize one of the main characters there that is kind of the protege of Robert Mitchum, he's really into it more for the fame and the adoration and all the things that come with it. And he lost sight of, we're just doing this for the money to buy the house for him and his wife. Yeah.
Yeah. But it isn't about writing. No, no. It's totally about writing. It's 100% about writing. Or like you said, about movie making in general.
Yeah.
You could extrapolate that to anything. But what I think is really an interesting cultural shift that partially has to do with time and, you know, the time in which these films were made versus now. But there is, I'm not going to say that there's a lack of hope, but there's a feeling in the modern films that we watched that it isn't that you're longing for some glory days that have passed. Mm-hmm. There are no glory days. I mean, Bull, to a degree, you do see a little bit of that. But even then, you know, it was never, you never achieved that level. You're just hanging on. And I think this is also true for the writer. These modern takes on rodeo film are more about people just hanging on, young people just hanging on.
Yeah.
They haven't had their glory days and now it's over. There have never been any glory days. They're just hanging on. Yeah. And I think there's something to that loss of the American dream, the cowboy fantasy. Even people who still say they want it, it doesn't feel real anymore the way it did then.
Yeah. And I think that's also a good contrast with the modern films a little bit, because you know, there's more of a romantic notion in some of the at least the idea of some of the Westerns that were made back then, even though these are very stark movies. When you kind of go in, you might think one thing and it's a totally different experience by the time the movie ends. But one of the movies that really, I think, affected me about rodeo in the last several years was The Rider, had you seen that one?
I had, yeah. Because the CTE, traumatic brain injury, that's my jam. So,
yeah. Had you seen Songs My Brothers Taught Me by Chloe Zhao?
That one I have not seen. And it's harder to find.
Yeah. It's harder to find. I think it was like on Mubi for like 2 minutes. I don't know if it's there anymore, but yeah. I think those films together, but The Rider, I mean, just, what a powerful film. And again, you're dealing with, I think, you know, we have people here. One of the things I love about the modern era, we're talking about two movies that were made by women and also a film that was made in Brazil. So we're getting other avenues into this world, which I think is very important.
And also, absolutely. And then also you have, I'm not exactly sure if the main character of the writer is First Nations or, but there seems Dakota. To be an implication.
Yeah, that
he's a First Nation. So you have a shift from the dying white masculinity of Rusty Men and the Misfits and Junior Bonner is all about this kind of lost myth of white masculinity.
Yeah.
And all of the new ones. I mean, and this isn't obviously isn't all of them because there's a million others that, that are. But the ones that we decided to look at for this are offering these other perspectives. You have the Black rodeo, you have First Nations rodeos, you have, you know, people who are coming from different perspectives, you know, and the whole idea of including a foreign film.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that was such a great idea. Yeah, it was kind of a last addition because we weren't sure, we had to postpone it. I had some tech issues. We were able to work in another film. And of course, Krista knows so many great movies in the world of rodeo. But I was really glad to discover a film that was made outside the States dealing with rodeo because it was totally unexpected. Yes.
And I don't think, I think that film and also Bull, they are far from perfect films.
Yeah.
But I think they both have a lot of flaws or things that just didn't really land or didn't set right with me.
You know,
but I love including them because I really like that contrast. And also just shout out to Nate Justice. My buddy, bullfighter Nate Justice, is on camera in Bull. He's one of the guys who is fighting bulls in the PBR with the main character in Bull.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so I had to give him a shout out on this.
Yeah, yeah. Which one do you want to dive into?
I feel like let's start with the writer because I feel like Bull and Neon Bull are kind of like weird, like dark
they
siblings.
And I like what you're saying. I think we're probably in sync on that. Like, there's so much I like in each film, but they don't really work overall. But they're still really worth checking out in order to get these, as you were saying, these other perspectives. And just to see where the state of, you know, bullfighting and rodeo is today around the world. And I think it was important to explore. The Rider is the only one of the modern films that I had seen, but it had been a number of years. So I was really glad to go back and watch that. What was interesting about this is I think she met him when she was making songs My Brothers Taught Me. And she said she thought she was discovering, and she compared it to Heath Ledger watching him tame a horse because just how natural he is and how he has to adapt and be emotional and change on a dime and do this. And she just thought this is somebody who can carry a film. And her partner is her cinematographer. And so they kind of just used all their credit cards. And she talked about doing lights from like Walmart, the LED strips, and like a crew of like six people. And
that's fantastic.
What was interesting is he admitted that a documentary crew was going to follow him until he got hurt. And then they like bailed. And she thought that's so dumb because that's where the story really starts. And that's the story she wanted to tell. What happens to someone who this is all he knew? He knew how to tame horses and how to do rodeo. And this is what he was trained for, his way of life, ancestors. And then what do you do after that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really fascinating to me. And, you know, just again, that idea of sacrificing your physical body for the entertainment of others, that is like a really powerful, that was what drew me originally, you know, to that film was that question. And in my books, in the first Angel Dare novel, she's an adult film star, and she is forced to kind of uglify herself in order to escape detection, and feeling as an aging star what it's like to no longer be visible and to not be seen for what you were.
Mm-hmm.
There's a parallel there to the idea of the documentary crew only wants to film you if you look cool.
Yes.
As soon as you fall, as soon as you fail, as soon as you're not like that all-American hero that everybody expects, then that's when, you know, you get what we like, the stories that we like to see that are much more interesting to viewers like us.
Yeah. And also one thing I forgot to mention when we were talking about the Misfits that I read this morning with Houston is he was saying how the car accident with Montgomery Clift had done actual brain damage. First of all, he couldn't see very well. He had cataracts. But he said he had kind of lost, and he was trying to not let people know, because as an actor, your whole bread and butter is on that. Not let people know that he couldn't memorize much anymore or very well. And he said what was really good for Clift on the Misfits is the lines were very short and direct. And he didn't really fully get that there had been a total, like, a brain damage, brain injury. And so it was kind of like, you can imagine in that scene in the alley with Marilyn Monroe, he's talking and he's pulling right from his own life. And so then when we have the writer and they only love you when you're perfect. Yes, it's kind of the same idea. And so it was kind of a weird synchronicity of having an actor who couldn't let, you know, everyone know that this was going on, and he could maybe relate to the character he's playing on a level he can't talk about. Yeah.
Well, of course, now, speaking of brains not working in an optimal manner, I can't, of course, remember my dates exactly, but I remember very well there was a writer named Ty Pazaban who committed suicide.
Oh.
And when that happened, and I've always said when I first was introduced to the world of rodeo, really, it's the women. The women run everything. The women wear the pants. The women decide whether you, an outsider, are okay to come in and talk to people or not. And the women are really, they are very powerful. And it was Ty Pazaman's mom who pushed to have his brain examined for CTE.
Oh, wow.
It was just riddled. And he was young, too.
Oh my God.
I don't even think he was, he might have been 20-something. Mm-hmm. Young, 22, young kid. And it was just absolutely riddled with brain damage. And so she was the one who was trying to break through that old rub some dirt on it, old son.
Yeah.
Kind of mentality of like, you're all right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like shake it off. You know,
you have another event.
Some of what... Exactly. Like, that's exactly, you know, well, why are you doing this? Because I'm entered.
Yeah.
You know, but I personally witnessed some egregious personal injuries that were shook off and viewed as nothing, because that's what you do. And she was able to break through that and say, listen, you know, this is real. Because a lot of the guys that I had talked to in the beginning were those football players are a bunch of pussies. You know, they just want money. You know, it's like, so you get hit in the head. You know, I get hit in the head 12 times before breakfast, I'm fine.
Yeah.
But she broke through that, and she really made people understand, you know, that this is a real thing and it is a serious issue. And, you know, I don't know if it was her in particular, but if you watch the PBR now, you see majority of the contestants wear helmets.
That's good. Yeah. My goodness. That is interesting to know. I wouldn't have guessed that the women run things, because one thing that's so fascinating about the rider and also Bull is they were made by women. And so you kind of wondered, like, what would it have been like for a woman to access this world? And so I love that when you were accessing it too, you saw, nope, they were going to make sure you were okay. And and what it was like.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, this is kind of true in life, is that, you know, let the guy go do man things, but, you know, who's doing the laundry? Who's making sure everybody gets food? Who's making sure everybody gets to be, you know, who's feeding the horses? Who's getting everybody there on time? You know, it's the women. And now this is something that I saw come up a couple of times in what we were watching, but I've seen this and it's starting to bug me as like a trope. What is the taciturn, grumpy older guy and cute Muppet girl thing? Because just, it's a drinking game for like modern like TV shows and movies. Like, yes. I'm just seeing it again and again and again. And I, even though I don't feel that Bull was a totally successful film, I liked the young girl character in that film more than almost any other, because she was so, first of all, she came off as very uniquely herself and not trying to be cute or sympathetic.
Yeah. I was
like, she was kind of a fuck up. And I liked that.
Yeah. I think I liked the character. I mean, no shame on the actress or maybe how she was directed, but I don't know that I loved the performance, but I loved the idea of this character. And because that was a unique experience. Yeah. She wasn't just this adoring, kind of following around girl. Yeah.
And that she wasn't there's basically two ways that you can be, right? You can be, oh, like a helpless, cute Muppet. Oh, no, don't hurt me. Or you can be like plucky, red-headed, like girls can too write crime.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, you know, like the Lois Lane syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, that you, and then the guy has to get you out of the situation you've gotten yourself into with your pluckiness.
Yes.
You know. But with her, it was like, I felt like there was something just, she was not, the writers did not shy away from unlikability. That was not a likable character.
No.
But yet, she had little moments where you really felt for her.
Yeah, I thought I was just going to say the entire plot line with the mom in jail and the grandma, I thought that was really unique. And, you know, like we do see in Neon Bull, a girl and her mother, you know, going around with these men, and the mom is the driver, but also a sexual performer. But I thought that was really interesting and of the moment in Bull, that it was like, you know, usually you would have kind of the Daniel LaRusso or the boy who's going through a tough time, but she's not one of those girls who within the first 5 minutes you're like, oh, she's going to learn her lesson and now she's going to be good. Or, you know, as the movie goes on, she's still kind of a brat. And you also see, though, other little glimmers of her wanting her mom, but also knowing that, you know, she might be headed down this path or this idea that we're going to get a home in Oklahoma, I think it was, or what's going to happen.
But you, I mean, I don't know about you, but for me watching that, it's like, you knew from the moment she said that, that wasn't going to happen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And yeah. It's like in a war movie when the buddy talks about the girlfriend, you're like, he's toast. Yeah.
Dead. He's dead. Guaranteed. But what I found really an interesting contrast between the older movies and the new ones is that hopelessness or that feeling of existential stagnation and despair that, like, oh, you know, I'm going to have this land in Oklahoma. Oh, I'm going to learn to ride bulls. And if this were a different type of movie, it would just be a standard sports movie where the curmudgeonly old coach, you know, gets the what was the Clint Eastwood the boxing
$1 Million
movie,
Baby?
$1 Million Baby. That it would just be $1 Million Baby, but rodeo.
Yeah.
You know, and it subverted that because the notion is that people who are not in this world of nostalgia for white masculinity, they're never going to get there. They don't mm-hmm. have nostalgia for that because they never had it. Mm-hmm. They never had power. They never were top of the heap. They've yep. always been on the bottom, and they always will be. And I think both the bullfighter character and the young girl are, I'm not going to say they're victims of circumstance, because they're also victims of their own fatalism and fuck ups and their own,
yeah,
you know, mistakes that they keep making over and over again. But there's something powerful in that understanding the difference between fighting against forces that you can never beat versus fighting against the forces of wages and a happy marriage. And, oh, it would be so terrible if you were forced to settle down, as opposed to, you know, you got to give the guy a hand job while he's playing a video game.
Yeah.
You know, and then, but that's just what you do. It's not yeah. like, it's not like you ever had glory to look back to.
Yeah.
Just hanging on.
Yeah. Just getting through it's a cyclical, the circumstances, socioeconomics. And I think, especially starting with the writer and Chloe's interest in realism and kind of almost like neorealism or the natural wanting these people to be as real as possible. I think, yeah, she wants to, and we saw that with Nomadland, for better and worse, people have a lot of opinions on that movie. But, you know, just kind of reflecting where we are. There's no, oh, she's going to work, you know, 60 hours a week and then she'll be fine after that. And then she can, you know, have a normal life after that. There isn't that other side to it. And I think it's kind of like the end of the Misfits with the horses. There's a little bit of optimism, but you can kind of see it's just these people are just following down this path. And here it's like they can't escape it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think that with the writer, there is an interesting push and pull between the majestic is the wrong word, but the visual,
yes,
the stunning visuals in that film, contrasting with the smallness of the life of this guy and his sister and their yeah. small struggle. Whereas I think both Bull and Neon Bull take a visually smaller, like visually tighter.
Yep.
Neon Bull has some beauty in its ugliness. Bull is, I think, almost, I'm not going to say documentary style, but it doesn't aspire to make anything beautiful out of what it's showing you. It's just showing you. So you're just seeing what you're seeing. Yeah. Whereas with the writer, I feel like there's a kind of a longing.
There's a contrast.
A nostalgia.
Yeah.
Visually, there's a visual nostalgia that doesn't exist in the lives of the characters.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
It does. It's like we're watching, you know, some of the shots of Days of Heaven, you know, like Chloe said, there's never going to be a magic hour she doesn't want to shoot at, essentially. But at the same time, the story we're watching, it's like we're watching a 70s, these characters are doomed kind of thing going on, but like set in the most beautiful, expansive, kind of a contrast of the claustrophobia and the smallness and the wide open spaces. And I think Bull, there's a lot of handheld, probably on the fly sort of get in, get out, because I'm sure it was shot very quickly. And it's not as visually interesting. I think Neon Bull, it's such a weird movie. It's
deeply weird.
What's so funny too is it's super sensual. And it's a dude making a sensual movie set in this world about a guy who wants to be a tailor or a fashion designer or make clothes. Then at the end, it like basically turns into a porno for a couple minutes. And it's a very strange film, but visually you don't know what's going to happen from one moment to the next. Like, there's some really interesting choices that were made. One of the choices that was fascinating to me, I think, as a woman is, you know, because later in the movie, it does get explicit. I mean, it's in shadow and stuff, but there's a scene and it's just very matter of fact. She is the driver of the, and she is waxing herself in the front.
I love that.
And what I love is it's from the side, like it's not exploitative. We're not like looking at her doing it or, you know, extreme close-ups. Like we know what she's doing. And she's just waxing herself. And she's got the towel there to protect modesty if somebody should walk by. And it's just so like, that's a scene. It's almost amazing to me. I don't want to like generalize and go, a dude put that in the movie, but I love that. Yeah. I thought that was
very real.
Yes.
Very real. And I am a big fan of like incidental or irrelevant nudity.
Yes. Yes.
Or just, you know, just naturalistic. Like people aren't like, you know, they're just, she's not in a flattering position. She's kind of hunched
not at
with
all.
Her legs up.
Yeah.
You know, and
it
I
looks
and
painful.
I love that.
It's very like, I got to do this in order to, you know, perform at night, essentially. And I was just going to say what was funny too is the contrast of her almost lack of vanity there, just like doing that. Versus this young guy who joins the rodeo and he's all about his braces and he's got a hair straightener and, you know, he's just like primping himself every 2 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I mean, you know, it has some great stuff and it also has some beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the scene where he has to jack off the horse, it's like somehow like this gorgeous. Like
yeah, it's backlit.
Lighting,
backlit.
And I'm like,
this is so weird.
Actually, that's actually happening. It's not implied. It's there. And he's, hey, look, still doing it. He's going to work there on it. But
I read the actor made the director do it first in order to, he was like, I can't. And so he made which is kind of an old filmmaking trick. The director shouldn't ask the actor to do something they're not prepared to do. And so, you know what? The director acted. And so he's like, so we both did it.
That's amazing. That's amazing. But like, but even the quote unquote porno, like the explicit sex scene that's in there is beautifully shot and a little bit awkward. It's not perfectly
it's more natural and
and it just and it feels and it's a that's pregnant woman and all of this but that's all a big part of this kind of showing you day-to-day life but in a beautiful way. The scene where he's picking through the scraps in the mud to find little pieces of fabric and pieces of mannequin that he can put together. It's like, that's a really striking, visually striking scene of a really mundane, unexciting happening.
Yeah. Or when he takes one of the porno mags of the guys that is, you know, on tour with him and opens it up and you think, well, I know where this scene is going. And he starts drawing on it. And it's like, wow.
He starts drawing costumes on it. Yes. Yeah. I mean, So I think that
stuff
also,
is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. With the writer too, there's a visual beauty, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of transcends the material. But I think that I do have a soft spot for Bull just because it is the only film that is 100% centered on bullfighting.
Yes.
And just for the audience at home, let's clarify, we're not talking about Spanish style.
No, we're not talking about matadors. Yeah.
We're not talking about matadors. We're talking about rodeo protection athletes.
Yes.
Which previously known as clowns, but the current crop of rodeo protection athletes do not like to be referred to as clowns. They are not funny. Nothing that they do is funny. They are there specifically. They consider themselves to be like almost paramedics in a way. Their job is a very serious job, like firefighters.
Yep.
You know, and that movie doesn't touch on freestyle bullfighting at all, but there is within rodeo a separate sport, which is, I wouldn't call it bullfighting. It's more like bull avoiding, professional bull avoiding.
Yeah.
You know, in that there's no rider. It's just the guy and the bull. And, you know, the bulls are fine. They go from town to town. They fight over and over and over again.
We're not killing the bull. Yeah.
Oh, no. Guys like to brag about that. They like to brag about that. They say, we are tougher than the Spanish guys because, you know, the bulls that they fight have never fought before. They don't know what's happening. So they're easy to beat. It's like guys who think smashing virgins makes them a good lover when in reality, you know, all that makes you is, you know, a guy who can trick women into saying yes once. You know, but she's not going to come back for more. But the bulls that these guys fight, they learn. They learn. They know what you're doing. You know, a lot of guys won't wear bright colored cleats because they know to watch your feet. That if your body is going to fake, they learn to look at your feet. Just because you're faking this way, if your feet are staying here, they know that's where you're going. So fighting the same bulls over and over can lead to a lot more challenges. And when you have bulls that are considered athletes, like in the PBR, you know, where these are like $1 million athletes, right? Everybody knows them. All the fans know them, the riders know them, and the bullfighters know them and their behavior. Okay. So it does become more of a dance, you know, more of a two-way back and forth.
Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there. But that was why I picked Bull as one of our movies, even though I don't think it's the best of the rodeo movies, but it's near and dear to my heart, A, because of Nate Justice being in it, and B, just because of being centered around a sport that I don't think a lot of people really know about.
Yeah, I learned so much, and I'm glad that I got the chance to see this one. I think I couldn't remember if I had seen it or not, but it wasn't ringing a bell when I watched it. So I was really glad to get the opportunity to check it out. And I know there were other movies when we were talking about doing this topic where you're like, well, Born Reckless, you know, but it's not. Are there any other films that you want to give a shout out to? I know we referenced a few others.
Oh my gosh. Now I can't remember. I'm kind of obsessed on finding this Richard Widmark film, which looks deeply creepy, but I'm a completist and I need to see it.
I love Widmark.
Richard Widmark is probably one of my favorite actors from that era. But, you know, so obviously there was that. I mean, you know, eight seconds. I mean,
yeah, that was actually going to be on my list. I haven't seen it in years, but I remember liking it. There were a few around that time period. There was 8 seconds. Yeah. I don't remember. My heroes have always been cowboys, but it was around that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple others.
Well, 8 seconds. And there are a couple of others that are, they're a little soapy. You know, they're sort of more about like, you know, a romance, and you could just as easily tell the exact same story. The guy is a cop, or he's a firefighter, or he's a baker, or candlestick maker, or whatever. That him being in rodeo is not necessarily relevant to the story. The story is more of a, you know, a romance. Mm-hmm. But there's also The Honkers, which is just a full-on comedy, basically. but that's, you know, entertaining. Amusing. I have to give a shout out. I will not go off on this tangent, but I got to give a shout out to Stoney Burke.
Okay.
All right. Stoney Burke was a TV show starring Jack Lord, was a rodeo show that it was almost as if the entire crew from The Outer Limits just was airlifted out of a science fiction show and just dropped into this rodeo show. So especially visually, you can see all these connections. I'm a big fan of The Outer Limits, and I especially love like Conrad Hall and the beautiful black and white cinematography. And you see a lot of that connection between what they were doing on The Outer Limits and this show, Stony Burke, which, if you have a chance to check it out, highly recommended. There's some really great episodes, lots of fun.
Okay. When was this on the air?
I want to say 60s.
Okay.
But like early. I think it was after The Outer Limits, just okay. after. So yeah, oatmeal.
Oh no, you're fine. I put you on the spot. So it's my fault. Yes.
Well, yeah, I probably, if I was going to give a shout out, I probably should have had something cleverer say about it.
I like that idea though. Yeah, I'll have to look for it. I'm sure YouTube is going to have some clips. So we will find it. Yeah.
Well, it's one of those, the premise is something that is so easy to, because you go from town to town. So you want to make a TV show. Here's a guy who goes from town to town and he gets, you know, murder of the week, monster of the week, trouble of the week, whatever it is. You know, he finds himself mixed up in various situations. So.
Yeah. Well, I am super excited. I want to ask before, just to remind everyone, the Get Off coming out in February of next year. February is going to be a good month. We have Krista's new book. We have William Boyle's new book comes out in February. So we've got some good stuff. So are you doing a book tour? Do you know what's going on yet for it? Are you coming to Poison Pen?
I really want to do the Farewell Angel Dare tour.
Okay.
You know, I really want to kind of like, because it's a big deal for me, a closure for me in my life, and as well as, you know, for the character. But the one thing that I'm definitely doing is I'm going to be at Left Coast Prime in Denver, which, you know, is I went to one of the rodeos that I went to during my research was not in Denver, but in Greeley, Greeley Stampede. But yeah, that's a big rodeo town. So that's going to be for sure.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So I forgot to ask you too, for quick premise, like what is Angel Dare doing in the world of rodeo?
Okay, so what happens to her over and over in these stories is that she'll find herself in a pickle. She'll find herself in trouble. She has been found out and she has to go on the run and ends up getting mixed up with these people. So in this particular story, she reaches out to an old friend from the second book who had originally tried to give her papers to get across the border. And he says, look, that's not a good idea now, but I have a friend who can help you. And the friend, of course, is a bullfighter. And so that's how she winds up kind of being sucked into the world of rodeo. And the whole story also has to do with telling a small white lie that kind of grows out of proportion from the retelling of other people. And you just don't contradict it. So the longer that you don't contradict the lie, the deeper and more troublesome it gets. And so it has a lot to do with that too. But that's how she winds up mixed up in rodeo.
Okay, everyone pre-order that. That sounds really good. But Krista, thank you so much.
I'm very bad at this.
Oh, thank you so much for doing this. This was so much fun.
Very, very fun. Very fun. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I know that I have a tendency to sort of pop off on tangents I hope this all made some kind of sense to somebody out there. And hey, buy my book. Even if I don't explain it well, I promise it's really good.
Yes. Well, I'm excited. Yes. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the Free Music Archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.